We're all in trouble together. That makes it seem less troublesome. All right, we're all in this together. You feeling good? You heard the president speak today on the economy for 45 minutes. Once again, reiterating what the plan is, what the game plan is. Big economic speech today. Surely you feel better about that. Or maybe you're mesmerized by the pirates. Because now that the networks have discovered pirates, they like pirate coverage. Hey, there's more pirates and more ships. We could mine this sucker endlessly. Who wants to report on the global economic meltdown? Who wants to report on the struggles between banks and auto companies today? Let's find another pirate ship. Let's find another drama that can be made for a TV movie. How about the teabaggers? So don't even know how ludicrously ridiculous the name is. Preparing tomorrow to rush the country and cause trouble. Here you go. Turn it up, John. It's the teabaggers. They're going to do it tomorrow. High taxes. Taxation without representation. Neither taxes have changed. And everyone's represented. And nothing's changed. But they'll be in the streets. All right, so a little bit of my initial thoughts for the day coming up on the program today. Tucker Carlson, you know, from, Tucker's been everywhere a little bit, hasn't he? On all the networks at one point, Crossfire, MSNBC, a conservative talk show host, is going to join us to debate some of the hot issues of the day. On the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY. The number to the program, 1-888-64-NANCY. I am going to get the, I know that some people complained that they want the actual numbers. I don't have them in front of me, but I will get them soon. Lots going on today, obviously, with economic news and politics and the big marches, tax day tomorrow. We'll be debating all of that stuff. But I've been thinking, you know, today you have the president out there trying to explain what happened today in his speech. It was 45 minutes. I've got lots of sound from it. If you missed it, don't worry. I've got you covered. We got it cut up. And trying to explain what happened, what needs to happen. It's so complex. And as you know, or if you don't know, I've been reading this book, the FDR book. It's bizarre because it's the New Deal years, 1933 through 1937, Ken Davis. And the analogies in here are to what we're going through in the crisis are so it's bizarre, honest to God, with the characters involved, with the types of problem, with the political dynamics going on, that it's to me electrifying that I'm reading this book at this time. And here's what really struck me about today in this speech. The president really has to get out there and explain this, because this is not your ordinary recession, okay? That's why these people don't get it, or the people organizing, the teabaggers, they get it, but they're just trying to confuse the rest of you about this is about socialism or high taxes, blah, blah, blah. And so he's trying to explain this very complex economic event called deflationary downward spiral I've been talking about for a long time. FDR had the same He took office with the same thing. There was a bank crisis. In fact, they shut down the banks on the eve of his. He made that call as soon as he had power to shut down all banks, a national bank holiday. He used an existing authority to do it with a plan to reopen, and they had to make all of these decisions of the same kind of bank crisis, same kind of recession, severe unemployment, housing. It was the same sort of perfect storm in a lot of ways. We learned those lessons, then we unlearned them, tell you the truth. So as I'm reading this book, he said that they actually said that his secretary of the Treasury, his name was Moley, said, Raymond Moley, to be accurate, declared in a famous line about this, "We saved capitalism in 8 days." Well, it wasn't quite 8 days, but they took a lot of bold steps right as soon as he took office, and had to. And that's what the president talked about today, is all on having to attack all these things on all fronts. And here's what's interesting to me. In looking back over it, FDR was trying to figure out the political strategy for getting through all of these major programs right away with the Congress that he had. And he summed it up. He said he had two stratagems for getting these programs through, to get them to work. The first was his famous fireside chats, where he took to the radio and airwaves and talked to the people, much like we heard today with the president, just going to the people, always going out. Here's what's happening. Here's our solution. Here's what we're doing, and doing that. And I think that this was it's a longer fireside chat. The second one was a revision of the Volstead Act. And we're going to talk about that, because basically it was allowing the beer loophole is what it was, to get Congress to distract them long enough so that we could get the bills passed, make them go, force them to go along. Okay, so back to the first stratagem. It's so hard to explain a global economic meltdown. It really is. And so I'm thinking, how can you take it with all these metaphors, and what can we do to simplify how we're going to get through this? And it just hit me, just hit me, that the classic model for this was, when I was a kid, Schoolhouse Rock, right? We knew, is that, okay, all righty, that's just John messing around with me. Schoolhouse Rock, right? We all remember Schoolhouse Rock, right? And we learned our...
I'm just a bill.
That's how we learned politics.
I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday, at least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
Gee, Bill, you certainly have a lot of patience and courage.
Well,
all right, so a bill is a bill. That's what we need, I determined. We need a new version of Schoolhouse Rock for a global economic meltdown. Just something really simple, so that yes, the president will give his 45-minute speeches and you know all that. He has to do that. He has to sort of digest it for us. But we need to simplify it. So it came to my attention. Let's put it this way, through a listener to the program, Mr. John Weber, that the person who wrote A Bill is a Bill is one of our residents of beautiful Portland, Oregon, KPOJ, one of our affiliates, who wrote that original song, A Bill is a Bill, for Schoolhouse Rock, and lives in Portland, still resides in Portland. Dave Frischberg is an American jazz pianist, vocalist, and composer, originally from Minnesota, but lives in Portland now, and composed that as well as hundreds of other tunes. He wrote one called My Country Used to Be that was big a few years back during the Bush administration, and it has obviously proven that he can put lyrics to music and relate simple concepts to people. So we asked Dave to come on the show and help us to find a new A Bill is a Bill for a global economic meltdown, and we're happy to say we have him, and here he is. Hi, Dave. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Nancy. I'm glad to be there.
So, first of all, I'm fascinated because Schoolhouse Rock, I reference it often in my edumacation. How did you get that gig? Was that did you originate that, or did someone hire you out to do this?
Well, I used to write for Schoolhouse Rock back in those days when it first started. My friend Bob Dorrell was musical director of that. And he got so much work and got so tied up, he began to farm out the work, and I got some of it. And one of my assignments was I had my choice of a few topics, and I chose how a bill becomes a law in Congress. little did I know that I was writing something that would become so well known, practically the best known of all of my songs. And many people think that's my crowning achievement, actually, is I'm just a Bill.
Well, no, you have a lot of great songs. List for them for me what you believe to be your crowning achievement. That's interesting.
With my what's my finest achievement?
What you think it is?
Oh, I don't know, but I like I'm Just a Bill, but it's not typical of the way I write, but it was typical of the way I wrote for Schoolhouse Rock. I also contributed other songs to Schoolhouse Rock more recently than that, and my favorite of those is Walking on Wall Street. But about all, I think I did about a half a dozen songs for Schoolhouse Rock.
Oh, okay. And songs that have been sung by such legendary artists as Rosemary Clooney, Anita O'Day, Michael Feinstein, others, Mel Torme. So you've been there, done that. Okay, Dave, so here's, do you understand the challenge I put before you? I am often, as a radio host, and one who is deep in the trenches on finance and the economy, I'm trying to relate pretty complex subjects to listeners and make it easy. So you have the knack that I need. Let's put it that way. And I'm thinking when we come back, we're going to go to a break here, but when we come back, if you will indulge me, sir, with some of your creative thinking on how one would take global economic meltdown and deflationary downward spiral and compose, say, a simple jingle. This is the mother of all tasks for you, Dave Frischberg. Portland doesn't know what they've got headed their way. And we're going to have our listeners come back as well. And if they have suggestions, we're going to have a little fun with this. How do you do? It's 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. A bill is a bill. I'm trying to think. A dip is a dip. There's lots of ways we can do this or rewrite this. So 1-888-64-NANCY, Dave Frischberg, who wrote A Bill is a Bill for Schoolhouse Rock, is my guest, and we are trying to simplify the global economic meltdown on the Nancy Skinner Show.
The company too. That's called stock. Smart investors look to buy stock in a company that's going up in value. Here's a stock that's looking mighty good, I think. Whiz Bang Cola, that's my favorite drink. Looks as if their sales are going up sky high. Better call my broker and tell him to buy. Hello, Leroy. This is Lester.
I'm impressed with my attorney, Bernie. I'm impressed with his influential friends. He's got very big connections, so I follow his directions. Bernie knows his way around, and so I always do what Bernie recommends.
See how easy that is? My attorney, Bernie. You get that. My attorney is an influential person. It's easy. That is a song by Dave Frischberg, who is joining us on the program. Dave wrote Schoolhouse Rock, a lot of songs for them, including A Bill is a Bill, among others. And our challenge today, he's also a Portland resident, KPOJ, yay, go KPOJ. And our challenge today, I asked Dave to help me simplify the global economic meltdown again. We need a new A Bill is a Bill. So I'm putting that challenge out there, 1-888-64-NANCY, which is 1-888-646-2629, because I understand people are calling and going, we don't have those on our cell phones. So it's 1-888-646-2629. See, you got to make everything simple, and that's what we're doing. So I'm Just a Bill up on Capitol Hill was the first version. Now we're trying to figure out simple lyrics. Now, Dave, I am not a lyricist, nor did I stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, but I'm over the break thinking, okay, the banks jip, Goldman flips, and retail continues to slip. Can we work with that?
I'm not sure. I'm not really sure what you're driving at. But let me correct you first before we begin, or before we finish.
Sure.
And that is, the name of the song is not A Bill is a Bill.
I'm Just a Bill up on Capitol Hill.
I'm Just a Bill. And I think that would be more clear. People knew that was the name of it.
Yeah, I'm Just a Bill up on Capitol Hill. I apologize and stand corrected.
That's fine.
But we all know what it is. It was a simple cartoon that basically describe the legislative process.
That's right.
And now we're going through an economic crisis. Is there something in the works that you can think of that would be helpful in that regard?
For what, economics?
Yeah.
Well, the country, the song that you referred to a little while ago was called My Country Used to Be, and I wrote that in 1992, I think it was, during the rundown to the election with Clinton versus Bush Sr. Minnesota Public Radio asked me to write a song for a series of episodes they put on each week. For that, it was called Presidential Choices. They asked me to write a song about the economic problems, and I came up with that song, which is called My Country Used to Be. And that's not really a description of how it works, but it's more like a blues. It's not in the blues form, but it's a lament. It's a sadness that I feel just fell over our nation.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the way I put it. And later on, I rewrote the song more recently, and I made it more broad than just economics. It was about the world situation, and not in any kind of a preachy way, or not in any kind of a angry way. Actually, it was just a sad, sad song.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of going through some tough times again here, Dave, and perhaps it's time to get back to those keyboards and think of how to communicate what it is. Do you support the president? Do you support his economic agenda with trying to fix, as he said today, he's got, we're fixing the banks. We had to have a stimulus because we have a lack of void of spending, and we're going to make investments in the future. We're going to have, he said, a new foundation built on rock, not sand, for this economy.
That's what I heard this morning. I think a simplest way of looking at it from my point of view is what I think, rather than trying to understand the problems, I think we really got to know the names of the people who are involved. You think that's ever going to happen?
You mean of the administration or the last administration?
Both, everything. The people who are behind it, the people who profited from it. I wonder if we'll ever know.
Well, you can write a song about Bernie Madoff. Because that is, you got to admit, a name like Madoff, of that, the irony of that name alone is pretty bizarre.
Well, yeah.
All right, Dave, I'm so sorry. I am like 10 seconds to my hard break, which means I have to thank you so much for your contribution to society and my education, Dave Frischberg. Thanks so much. We really appreciate having you on the show.
Thank you, Nancy.
You bet. And when we come back, we'll take your suggestions for a new Schoolhouse Rock at 1-888-64-NANCY.
Since the problems we face are all working off each other to feed a vicious economic downturn, we've had no choice but to attack all fronts of our economic crisis simultaneously. Now, the first step was to fight a severe shortage of demand in the economy. So the Federal Reserve did this by dramatically lowering interest rates last year in order to boost investment. My administration and Congress boosted demand by passing the largest recovery plan in our nation's history. It's a plan that's already in the process of saving or creating 3.5 million jobs over the next 2 years. It's putting money directly into people's pockets with a tax cut for 95% of working families. It's now showing up in paychecks across America. And to cushion the blow of this recession, we also provided extended unemployment benefits and continued health care coverage to Americans who've lost their jobs through no fault of their own.
Well, there you have it, President today trying to explain the global economic meltdown in all of its complexity. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 646-2629. If you don't have those numbers on your phone, 1-888-646-2629 on the Nancy Skinner Show. All right, here's my dilemma. So I'm listening to all this. Obviously, I've been talking about these issues for a long time myself, trying to explain them. And we're going to have some fun coming up here at the top of the hour with Tucker Carlson, because I'm going to have, he's going to have some splaining to do. Tucker Carlson has joined the Cato Institute, so we're going to talk a little economics as well. But I'm looking at this very complex thing. He's trying to describe how he's dealing with it. And tomorrow we will see thousands of anti-tax demonstrations, tea parties. So apparently what these guys are trying to do, the tea baggers, and when I giggle, everyone will know, you should know why I'm giggling, Wikipedia tea bagger, tea bagging, the definition, I didn't realize this till it was brought to my attention. It's not the image they want. In any case, they're trying to have some connection made, tap into the visceral fear and anxiety of the public and use that to sort of say taxes are too high. So the Boston Tea Party, we know that. We've learned that. A bill is a bill on Capitol Hill. Boston Tea Party, we've been taught that from history. We know this. And that is the right wing's response to this, is to try to grab at that viscerally and say this is the Boston Tea Party all over again. This is socialism. This is about taxes. Even though it's not. No tax changes have been made, so they're really protesting Bush's tax policies, as was pointed out on a program I saw last night that was pretty funny, as well as the fact that the taxes are lower than they were during Reagan, the top marginal tax, even if it had taken place. But nonetheless, Paul Krugman writes in his column yesterday, Tea Parties Forever, although it's embarrassing to watch the GOP as they flounder over these things, he said the GOP looked as crazy 10 or 15 years ago as it does now. That didn't stop them from taking control of both houses, both Congress and the White House. And they could return to power if the Democrats stumble. So it behooves us to look closely at this, what's going on here, these tea parties, he says, and what they mean. So I'm trying to simplify. I had Dave Frischberg on, who wrote A Bill is a Bill. I was looking for a little help in terms of explaining the global economic meltdown. Not sure I got to that point yet. So I'm inviting your calls in terms of what is the counter. Here's a question. What is the counter to the tea parties that is completely unglued from the reality of the situation? Clearly, but it will have, as I said, it will have some legs, because people, it's an easy thing to understand, the Boston Tea Party. What is the counter to the Boston Tea Party as a song, as an event, as a metaphor, as a frame that is glued to reality, but is simpler than a 45-minute major speech on the economy delivered by the president himself? 1-888-64-NANCY. Greg is in Santa Monica. Hi, Greg. Thanks for calling and hanging on. Appreciate it.
Hi, Nancy.
How are you, sir?
All right. I get your point, and I agree, because he needs to come down to the level of talking directly to the people. This is what FDR did in his fireside chats, and be very elemental and basic, and not only educating people about, Schoolhouse Rock, as this applies to this situation, but also debunking the right-wing's disinformation juggernaut, which Roll Clinton is gearing up to roll Obama.
He did a little of that today. Let me just put, this is criticism to the stimulus plan, which I think the timing of this is no coincidence that he delivered this speech on the eve of this teabag thing. I think that they felt like they had to get out in front of this thing in case it takes, fire, and listen to what he said, and that's why I'm convinced it was so.
Yeah, but it was at Georgetown, Nancy. Georgetown is a high.
You will recall that
I'm sorry about that, Greg. I stepped on you accidentally. I'm sorry, what were you saying about Georgetown?
Yeah, my cell phone's not the best either, but he did it at Georgetown, which is always a high-policy speech. He needs to do it at the maybe not the sweaters, that's too Carter-esque, but he needs to do it at the FDR fireside chat level, where he speaks directly to these people who are so impressionable. And, there's probably 100 million rednecks in this country who want to hear.
I don't know what the census, U.S. Census Bureau data is officially on the number of rednecks. I wonder if we can get an accurate reading on that.
I was raised among them, and I know that there's a bottomless pit of people who want to hear the worst about the president, and the right wing is playing into that and ill-informing them and deliberately duping them
to
their own interests.
All right, listen to this, though, for one second. Hold on, Greg. Hold on. Here's the president responding to critics. So he was definitely going after doing exactly what you said, Greg, he should do.
Now, you will recall that some argued this recovery plan is a case of irresponsible government spending, that it's somehow to blame for our long-term deficit projections, and that the federal government should be cutting instead of increasing spending right now. So I want to tackle this argument head on. To begin with, economists on both the left and the right agree that the last thing a government should do in the middle of a recession is to cut back on spending. You see, when this recession began, many families sat around the kitchen table and tried to figure out where they could cut back. And so have many businesses. And this is a completely reasonable and understandable reaction. But if every family in America, if every business in America cuts back all at once, then no one is spending any money, which means there are no customers, which means there are more layoffs, which means that the economy gets even worse.
Which means you guys were, like, so wrong, is what he should be saying. All right, Greg, you see what...
Side speech in prime time.
Well, you know, he has had a couple of addresses in prime time.
Where and that gripped the nation. There was an immediate change in the tone of the right wing's bullying. Now they're on a roll. They think that they've got their troops ginning up, and they're going to roll him just like they did Clinton with these phony, laughable teabag parties.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what I'm saying. It can't just be the fireside chat. I'm rereading history. They said, FDR said he had two strategies for really being able to accomplish what he needed to, despite the odds. One was the fireside chats and influencing commentators like Walter Lippmann and whatnot. And two was modification of the Volstead Act, which was the prohibition on alcohol. So he said, I think, and I quote, I think now would be a good time for beer, he announced to his companions at the table. When he had been told by his legal experts that the Volstead Act could be constitutionally modified to permit the manufacture and sale of malt or vintage beverages having a low 3.2% alcoholic content. And you know what was so brilliant about that? Is that he knew that the Republicans wanted that they would pass his economy bill, as he called it, in order, if he dangled that bill in front of them, the Volstead Act, the Beer Act, that he could get his economy bill passed. And that's exactly what happened, that they went for it. So the other question I'm going to throw out there, Greg, and I do appreciate you calling in, is at 1-888-646-2629. That's 1-888-646-2629. Is what is that distraction? What is the modern-day modification of the Volstead Act? What is it that I was thinking about this? Honestly, when I'm reading the book, this book, I'm like, what is it that the GOP would give anything for, would want to happen, so that you could tamp down their craziness long enough to do what needs to be done, so the grown-ups can get in and fix the joint without having them nipping at your ankles? What is the modern-day modification of the Volstead Act? It has to be something that we don't really care a whole lot about. And I wrote down some things. I'll have to find my notes on what I was thinking might be a solution there. But if you have any ideas, we got a couple of ways to counter these tea parties is what we're trying to do in simple terms, because what we're talking about is so much more complex, as well as let the grown-ups do what they need to do and get these guys distracted long enough to get it done, apparently, is what I'm trying to do. Ishmael is in Los Angeles. Hi, Ishmael.
Hi, how you doing? First time caller.
Great.
I enjoy
right.
your show.
Thank you.
Real quick, the GOP party has been very crafty at preying on people's emotions. So I think that people are actually more visual. So maybe the way that we should tackle the whole tea party type of issue is that we make like a model where people can visually see the different income brackets and show what the old tax bracket would be like and what it would be under the Obama administration, so that people can actually see it and allow it to kind of digest instead of becoming an emotional type of decision, whereas the GOP always seems to prey on the people emotionally.
But don't you think, Ishmael, the reason is that emotions work? That's what campaigns are about. Numbers can get lost. And so any good media consultant tells a candidate or somebody who gets out, I'm careful to avoid this when I go on national TV. You get, when you start jumbling numbers around, they get lost. Some people, we all have different models of learning. So,
but it doesn't have to be actual numbers, kind of like the commercials for smoking. It can actually be a picture. It would be like a palette of money and say, this is what the top 1% makes, made under the Reagan administration, and this is what it's going to be making under the Obama administration, and this is what the person that's making under $250,000 would make, you know, vice versa. So people can, they don't have to actually see the numbers, but they see an actual block.
Well, here's where I think you're onto something, that you combine the numbers with pictures. So show this guy ExxonMobil, this CEO makes $23 million a year, we just found out. $23 million a year. So show that lifestyle, show that picture.
Right,
and there's this tax bracket.
Right.
And then take a look at some other people and what we're going through and what their tax bracket is and their lifestyle. Show an auto worker versus this guy, okay? Show a guy who's working at a fast food joint, whatever. And then I think you are onto something, my friend. Show the differences that they're out there rioting in the streets on. I am going to be fascinated to see how many people actually show up, much like the Notre Dame case where they had a big protest and five people showed up. I don't know, though. You know, I'll tell you, dismiss these at your own peril, these tea parties, because here's what I think. When a situation is as complex and confusing, you combine that with anxiety, financial anxiety, and people don't understand it, then you can say, Boston Tea Party, protest. I saw a little of that this past weekend. When we come back, I'll explain that to you. When I was trying to make the connection between Chase and Chrysler. It's easy to scare people. It's really easy and to have that thing get lit on fire. Real easy. 1-888-646-2629, I guess my question is, so how do you counter it? How do you counter the tea parties with something that makes sense? Glued to reality. Your thoughts on the Nancy Skinner Show.
Some who argue that the government should stand back and simply let these banks fail, especially since in many cases it was their bad decisions that helped create the crisis in the first place. But whether we like it or not, history has shown repeatedly that when nations do not take early and aggressive action to get credit flowing again, they have crises that last years and years instead of months and months. Years of low growth. Years of low job creation, years of low investment, all of which cost these nations far more than a course of bold, upfront action. And although there are a lot of Americans who understandably think that government money would be better spent going directly to families and businesses instead of to banks, and one of my most frequent questions in the letters that I get from constituents is, where's my bailout? And I understand the sentiment. It makes sense. Intuitively and morally, it makes sense, but the truth is that a dollar of capital in a bank can actually result in $8 or $10 of loans to families and businesses. So that's a multiplier effect that can ultimately lead to a faster pace of economic growth. That's why we have to fix the banks.
Did you get that? That's why we have to fix the banks. Very eloquent President Obama trying to do his best to get out and... It's a preemptive strike, really, I believe, against the teabaggers who are going to take to the streets tomorrow. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-888. That's 1-888. That would be 3 8s in a row. 646-2629 or 64 Nancy. But 646-2629, the number of the program. I think a lot of people are debating whether that you just ignore these guys. I think Paul Krugman in his piece, Tea Parties Forever, yesterday, He said, look, it's pretty funny. He said that they are embarrassing to watch at this point. And also it doesn't feel right to make fun of crazy people. But he also said, you know, be careful, beware of what's going on here because it could be tapped into. And do you get out in front of it or do you ignore it? I think in this particular circumstance, you have to get out in front of it and educate. The solution to the attack of using fear, anxiety, and emotion in this kind of bizarre fashion, which is being organized by this is not a grassroots, spontaneous implosion of people to the streets, au contraire, as has been pointed out by numerous bloggers and Paul Krugman himself, Jane Hampshire, and others, that these are AstroTurf events manufactured, if you will, by these same old usual suspects. Paul Krugman cites a key role being played by FreedomWorks, an organization run by Dick Armey. Remember him? Dick Armey? David Schuster had a lot of fun with Dick Armey running the teabagging events across the country. And supported by, he says, the usual group of right-wing billionaires. And the parties are, of course, being promoted heavily by Fox News. And if you saw me yesterday on Fox News, I was not pulling any punches in my interview on Neil Cavuto's show. I went right at the culprits, in my view, which were the banks. So I think that the president is doing what he needs to do as a president, which is to explain this. Something a caller just said that he needs to have it more dumbed down a little bit, vis-a-vis the fireside chats, as FDR did. It is. It's complicated stuff. But you got to get out in front of it. You've got to explain it and keep talking and keep talking. But I think he needs more than just us. Al, you got like 10 seconds.
Yeah, I think Obama did the right thing by getting out in front of it, because now they'll be responding to him instead of it appearing that he's responding to them.
Oh, okay. So now when they come to the street, they'll say this is... You know, yesterday the media reporters will then cite both of what they had to say about an issue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Basically, they're responding now to his message as opposed to him having to react to theirs.
Right, right, right. Hey, you know what? That's a really good point, and I'm sure that's why why he's the president of the United States, because they think through these things. They saw this train coming. Coming up, Tucker Carlson. Oh, this should be fun. Haven't. A Tucker in a while? I don't know. On TV I have. But we'll get him on the radio, and we'll see what Tucker Carlson has to say about all this craziness going on his party. All on the Nancy Skinner Show. Trouble. That time again. Lots of trouble going on tomorrow. Tax day. April 15th. Ooh, riots in the street. Teabagging. Extraordinaire going on tomorrow because of the tax rates that didn't go up or change at all since the new president took office. It's the protest without a purpose going on tomorrow. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number of the program, the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm pleased to have Tucker Carlson join me. Tucker Carlson, you all know from TV, from Crossfire, CNN, MSNBC, had his own program, doing some stuff at Fox News, I believe, has just recently joined the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, kind of where I think Tucker ended up sort of settling in the libertarian philosophy as all these the turbulent TV days go. And I'm glad to have him on the show. Hi, Tucker.
Hey, Nancy. How you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Congratulations on your Cato gig.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
Now, are you doing anything formally with Fox? I mean, I know we've
no,
both
just,
done this.
No, I know all the guys there. I like it.
Yeah?
You know?
But you're not, there's not, you just do appearances and stuff now.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's, you know, pretty much every resident of Washington, D.C. who pretends to have a college degree even goes on TV at least twice a week. I mean, that's just kind of, you know what I mean?
Well, I thought I was special, but I do it from Detroit, so that makes it a little more difficult.
I think that's a little bit more impressive.
Yeah, you know, I have to, like, you know, get a satellite uplink and all this all the time.
Exactly.
And
you, so you live in Detroit?
I do. I lived in Chicago, ran against Barack Obama in the Senate primary for 12 years, but then I moved back to Detroit. That's where I'm from, and I've been doing my stuff from here. I've been, Tucker, I know we've done something. I've been, like, the resident liberal on Fox for about a decade. And I want to know what you make of, before we jump into this whole thing, what you make of the Fox going hard right and MSNBC kind of going hard left in terms of choosing their programming. Fox, you know, obviously promoting these tea parties, getting more involved in the editorial aspect of that,
right.
I would say. And MSNBC hiring Ed Schultz, so now clearly, you know, their lineup is left. What do you make of that? Is that just how TV gets ratings and works?
Well, as Phil Griffin, my former boss, the head of MSNBC, said when he hired Ed Schultz, who's a friend of mine, by the way, and a good, very good guy, I think,
yeah, no,
from
Ed.
My old hour at 6 o'clock, he said, we stand for something, and that's why viewers watch us. And I think, hey, you can argue about whether that ought to be the case, but there's no argument about its effect. It gets ratings. People want to watch their own views told back to them more eloquently and more passionately. They do. I mean, your show, I bet you $1,000 is listened to by people who agree with you, mostly. Not all. I mean, some people listen because they think you're interesting or they want to get mad or, you know, for whatever reason. But most people tune into radio and television programs about politics when they agree with what the host has to say.
Well, you know, I agree with that on the right. Look at Rush Limbaugh and his success and Sean Hannity. On the left, it's been a little different story. So I have people like you on. I have Grover Norquist was going to be on last week, Steve Forbes. I prefer the debate. I prefer spirited debate, actually, than the Amen Club myself.
Oh, I agree completely. Actually, it's boring as hell to have people on. I mean, I was the host of Crossfire for years, so I worked on one of the very last debate shows, maybe the last real debate show in all of cable television, you know,
right.
And where you had, like, adults debating, peers. There wasn't just one articulate voice and then one, you know, kid with a stutter. I mean, it was, you know, two adults. And I enjoyed it, but it turns out that viewers don't want that. We know that from the ratings. Ratings are a really good measure of what people want.
You know what? I don't know that that's true. I think that maybe that's an anachronism there, because if you brought back a Crossfire now, because politics back then, you know, everyone was just, the economy was good, things were good. Right now, everybody is so nervous, they don't know who to believe. So take these tea parties, for instance. This is a great topic. Is this for real? Are you kidding me that this is an anti-tax protest when they haven't even raised taxes yet? And we've got this downward deflationary spiral that Obama's talking about for 45 minutes today. People can't really understand. Isn't this the time when a really good debate could persuade people, or they would pay attention to it?
Well, you would think. We haven't had one for a couple reasons. One, in politics, you know, the only way you're going to get a debate is if you have two relatively equally matched parties, and you don't now. The Democrats are in charge of everything. They're resurgent. They're strong. They're much smarter than they were even 5 years ago. And the Republicans are in total disarray. They don't know who they are. They don't know who leads them. They don't know what they stand for. And they don't control anything. And so they're pathetic. That won't always be the case, but it is right now.
So then why the tea parties? I mean, because that, as Paul Krugman points out, it's embarrassing because it really, and Fox News says, well, there's going to be a backlash. Acorn's going to crash these parties and we're going to have feuds on the street. I don't think this makes them look like the grown-ups that they seek to be someday.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's obviously a result of frustration that people feel, which I think, you know, it's worth taking seriously. People feel like, you know, most people voted for Barack Obama, most voters did, but there were still, 58 million people who didn't. And who represents them? Well, the Republican Party doesn't. And the press isn't interested in this. I mean, they're writing about Obama's dog or how the Belgians love him or whatever, but the press is in every bit as much disarray as the Republican Party. You know, it's falling apart too, and so there are a lot of people who feel disenfranchised, and so what else do they do? I don't know. I mean, I thought liberals would be for ordinary people taking to the streets to have their voices heard. Why is that embarrassing?
Well, come on, because first of all, it's not a spontaneous people-based effort that it's being.
Neither was the March on Washington. I mean, Martin Luther King didn't just show up and have thousands of people meet him there by accident. It was planned around the country.
Yeah, but this is Dick Armey and Newt Gingrich and all these guys. I mean, where is the young generation of really intelligent thinkers that can, on your side of the aisle, maybe that's what you're doing over there, Tucker. I know you're writing a book for the Cato Institute. Because you need to reinvent the whole, you know, someone called the other day and said, where do I see common ground between conservatives and liberals? And I said, you know, it's the conservative ideology that doesn't bother me. Small government, lower taxes, that's all good stuff, you know, and there's yin and yang with that. It's that it's never been really tried. I mean, it's been...
Well, it certainly hasn't been tried. You're exactly right. It hasn't been tried. People don't want it. I mean, people want free stuff from government. They want other people to pay their bills. And once they figured out that you could have 2% of the population pay for everything, which is where we are now, rich people pay for everything. Without rich people, you wouldn't have a federal government. With most people. Well, sure. Look, half the country doesn't pay taxes.
So you don't... Wait a minute. So, Tucker, all right, tell me that I want to know this because I know you're a libertarian. You do support a progressive tax structure, correct?
I absolutely do not support a progressive tax structure.
You
at
do
all.
Not? You don't? Okay.
Absolutely. One man, one vote, one man, one tax rate. That's as far. I mean, every person in this country has the same rights, the same responsibilities as every other person. That's the whole point of America. So the idea that one person pays a higher percentage of his income, and by the way, I made $14,000 a year for a long time, and I was a married man, so it's not like I spent my life rich or something. You know what I mean? So, like, I've certainly been at both ends of the income scale.
I think that our society, that there's more to it than that. It's not, there are lots of founding principles, equality being one of them, but justness being another, and the idea that Bill Gates would pay the same tax rate as some, you know, poor schmuck who's got, you know, just lost his job, to most people is ridiculous.
Bill Gates would still pay a lot more in taxes, because he makes more money. But by the way, I'm glad you picked Bill Gates, because Bill Gates, no one handed Bill Gates anything. There's no government program made Bill Gates rich. No government research allowed him to become a billionaire. Government had nothing to do with Bill Gates' success.
Tucker, come on. I hope you include a chapter in your book on how much government has contributed, just to be fair and balanced, has contributed to the well-being of society. You know, if we didn't have the sewer lines and the police departments and the public education system and disease prevention, so we don't all have to have polio and all these things that allowed someone like Bill Gates.
I'm merely saying, why should Bill Gates have to pay a higher rate than any other person? That just strikes me as unfair. I mean, we should have the same rate for everybody. He's got every right that any other person has.
To whom much is given, much is required, okay? And that is, you want to talk moral principles?
As far as I know, unless I'm missing the story here, I don't think I gave Bill Gates anything, and I don't think you
nobody's
did
saying
either,
gave them.
No,
nobody's saying gave them. Saying, look at that. This society is built on that premise that the American dream, and not everybody is born into the same circumstances. And that I think the president, what he's trying to do now, is try to pick up the pieces of a failed philosophy. Let's flip this around a little bit, Tucker. You got to admit, after 8 years and tax cut, what it did in spending on two wars and taking away regulations for decades, it allowed this whole foreclosure crisis to go turn into a global meltdown. And
well, that's a multi-pronged charge, and there was a lot to what you just said, and I'm not sure I could answer all of it really in under an hour.
Well, then take the deregulation. Take the free enterprise without any regulation that allowed the leveraging that went on to blow up in our faces and cost everybody. So it's just, it's the opposite, Tucker, of what I was saying to you. It's not about to what you're given. It's we all got stuck with what the bankers handed us because of this.
And whose plan was that? That was the liberals' plan. My plan, and that was George W. Bush's plan, another liberal, the idea that you're responsible for someone else's failure. That's something that I and most sensible people reject out of hand and completely. If GM can't make cars that sell, that's GM's problem. If AIG insures things and can't make good on its policies, that's AIG's problem. If you can't keep your business above water, you face the consequences.
Except when your problem becomes my problem. That's the only problem.
But that's the point. It shouldn't be. It's these government bailouts, it's government intervention in this that puts us all on the hook for the misdeeds of these rich people that we all hate. Right? If they were just allowed to face the consequences, if your radio show goes off the air tomorrow, right, and you have no more income and you've got to pull your kids out of school or cancel your vacation or whatever, you face the consequences of failure, right? Nobody's going to bail you out, Nancy.
Seems simple enough a premise, Tucker, but the problem is that it's so intertwined because of lack of regulation that when they make a mistake and it's going to take us out, somebody's got to be grown up and take and put the system back.
Well, that's not going to be me. You're doing it for a grown-up. You got myself. Give me a buzz.
All right, Tucker Carlson. Hey, good to hear from you. We'll have to continue this conversation. Good luck. Keep writing that book. Get that chapter in there. Okay, Tucker Carlson from the Cato Institute now. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the show. 646-2629. If my show ends tomorrow, I'll be fine because life goes on with me. I just keep plugging along, trying to tell people about all the things we need to do so that we have a better life. And whatever happens, happens. What do you think? Time for your calls next on the Nancy Skinner Show.
Falling asleep at the wheel again, baby. You're drifting over the line, yeah. Your hands are tied, but you're losing grip quickly. Fix, make a new redesign. Coming your way.
All right, here we go. It is Nancy's control. Nancy and Tucker. You know, I've done some things. I mean, in our tours of duty on cable chatter shows, I can't remember. And I've met him once. I was in D.C., doing something, but that's Tucker Carlson writing a book for Cato Institute now, opining on the Tea Party. So let's get to your calls. 1-888-64-NANCY, 646-2629, if you have a mobile device without letters. Starting with Bob in Los Angeles. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Nancy.
How are you, sir?
Very well, very well. I have an idea to kind of express my frustration against the teabaggers. And against the kind of, you know, falsely generated sham that Fox News and FreedomWorks is doing, I think all your listeners should engage in a fun activity that I call cheeseheading. And now, I would describe that as you would give out the addresses of Fox News.
I like it already. Okay, go ahead. I'm with you.
Give out the address, Fox News, FreedomWorks, Rush Limbaugh Show. Have your listeners send small packets of inexpensive cheese, maybe slightly beyond their sell-by date, to the people and say, hey, cheesehead, Americans took back our country on election day 2008, remember?
Yeah. That's hilarious. The only thing is,
serious about it.
But what about the poor people up in Wisconsin behind the cheddar curtain? Are we dissing our friends in Wisconsin or no? Or is
not
that
at all.
Can we get
exactly
a permission slip? Okay.
I think that's kind of like saying you're not dissing the munitions makers in New England, you know, who are supplying, you know, ammunition for the Patriots. They're supplying the cheese to help.
Well, that's good. So we're cheeseheading now.
I think so. Cheeseheading. And it could be cheese food. You can go to the inexpensive stores. They shouldn't cost that much money.
Right.
I'd be the first one to do it.
For food-like product, you know, not like when you, most cheese, that they're cheese-like, or they say food product, which, you know, it's fake, right? It's fake cheese.
Right. I think that's fine.
It can't be real cheese, like real good. Like,
No. Inexpensive.
Definitely. And it should have hydrogenated fats in there, too.
Absolutely. Stuff that you really
it's bad for you.
You wouldn't want to eat, but I mean, it just gives them the impression, hey, that most Americans support Obama, and this teabagging nonsense should be confronted with cheeseheading. And I'm not being suspicious about this. My friends would be.
Complete with trans fats. I love it. Actually,
absolutely.
I love it.
Absolutely. So if you can get the addresses on the air and have hundreds and maybe thousands of little envelopes with little bits of cheese addressed to these people saying, you know, you are such a cheesehead, you forgot that we took back our country on election day. I've seen these commercials with this guy dressed up as Tom Paine saying it's the patriotic thing to do to send the tea bags to Obama and throw the tea. No, it's not the patriotic thing. It's a fraudulent thing. And
well, you know what's great about your idea, Bob, is that it bestows upon this event the silliness to which it deserves.
Yes, I think so. So,
okay.
If you get the addresses, the mail addresses, I would be grateful.
I am for it. We will get our crack staff on it, Bob. I think you've come up with something far better than I have. So
okay.
I'm with you. All right, buddy. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. All right. So cheeseheaders. I like it. So unless you have a better one than that, we are going to continue to talk about these tea parties, tea bagging. Did anyone get that? It's a family program, so I can't go into to length about tea bagging that they've described themselves as doing. But if you Wikipedia that, it's not the best choice of pictures, visuals for a protest of this scope. Cheeseheaders, though, that's on the table. And how do you compound that? President Obama did it today in an eloquent 45-minute speech. We're thinking of other ways. At 1-888-64-NANCY, that's 646-2629 in the Nancy Skinner Show.
Clear away the wreckage and address the immediate crisis. It is my firm belief that our next task, beginning now, is to make sure such a crisis never happens again.
Never, never again, says President Obama today in a speech at Georgetown University about the economy, a broad, bold plan for rescuing the economy, grown-up approach, actually, to solving the crisis. These guys, the tea baggers, left us. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner, 1-888-646-2629. Or 64-Nancy, or O-Nancy. So I'm Twittering now. I'm getting into it, right? So I'm Twittering, and I see the value of it. I got Twittered by Jane Hampshire over at Fire Dog Lake about a new post she has. It's about a wannabe teabagger in chief, Newt Gingrich, in hot water over $4 million in private flights. So get this. They're hailing, all these right-wing bloggers are hailing Newt Gingrich as kind of they're calling him the modern-day move-on guy. That he's come back and he's really rallying people. He's with an organization now called American Solutions that's playing a huge role in the organization of tomorrow's teabagging protest. So get this. So this outpouring, this mass of people who are just taking to the streets because they're worried about the marginal tax rate going up, which it isn't. This group filed some documents with the IRS saying that they paid out something like $4 million in the past 2 years to a company called Moby Dick Airways. It's a company that charters private planes for presidential candidates, RNC, and apparently American Solutions. Moby Dick Airways? I mean, what is it? If you people have a gender gap, I got to tell you, listen, all this phallic verbiage going on is not going to help you at all. In any case, the point is, you are no move on. I've met Wes Boyd and let's see, what's his wife's name? I'm trying to remember. Jean. And you, sir, are no Wes Boyd, Newt Gingrich. And this is not a spontaneous explosion of sentiment. Yes, you might be tapping into economic anxiety, but it's not because that there's going to be any future increase in the top marginal tax rate or that the government isn't fixing the broken economy that you gave them. So what we're trying to do here at 1-888-64-NANCY is think of ways that we can simplify this at the level. Because the idea is you know, the idea is good that you're trying to simplify it. People think Boston Tea Party. And so they're like, yeah, that, right, yeah. And there's a metaphor there. But we don't have that with the longer, bigger solutions that we have to look at. And investments in the future like energy, independence, and healthcare, those aren't easily, I guess, deconstructed into simple
one-day protests. Those are long, hard slogs, if you will. That's the janitor cleaning up after the party is over. Jeff is in California. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for hanging on.
Hi, Nancy. Yeah, I think one good way to get out in front of it is the same solution for just about every single problem that the Americans are feeling right now. And it's to hold the people who perpetrated these crimes accountable for the crimes they committed. Start frog marching people. I think that that would probably go quite a big distance for the fact that the biggest problem with any of the economic issues we're experiencing is confidence. And no one has any confidence that this isn't just going to happen again. So if you start holding some people accountable and showing the world we're dead serious about changing the ways things go on here, instead of pardoning people or commuting sentences of the only people that have been held accountable for any of the problems that have been that have occurred over the past decade, I think that that would be a pretty good way.
Let me ask you, Jeff, what you're talking about specifically, because there's the economic mess, and if you're talking about the torture and all that, that's a whole different story.
Actually, is it? I mean, but let's put it aside, but really it's not. It's the same exact issue. It's a confidence issue with the American people and the people of the world looking at our leadership because, well, let's just any of these crimes, but we'll push Guantanamo and everything else off to the side. But Mr. Obama, President Obama, all crimes have happened in the past, all of them, or they're not crimes yet. So to use that as an excuse for not prosecuting crimes,
all right, but Bernie here's what you got to Bernie Madoff is in jail. So
hardly. His wife is out spending money right, left, and center. They've been caught red-handed committing additional crimes right, left, and center.
And I think they're pretty
doing everything they can not to show the American public that we're wise to that kind of a thing.
I think that they're on that. That's why you know about the wife and the spending.
$9.5 billion going missing in Iraq that no one ever looked at? How about any of the tax hikes? How about two wars being completely hidden from the books, which is what is leveraging our children's futures? It isn't fictitious tax hike, marginal tax rate hike that's coming. It's the fact that two wars were never put on the books. And if President Obama would get out in front by speaking not in the hypotheticals of the future, but in the facts of what has already transpired, it would be very easy for the American people.
So, Jeff, I'm going to put this out there. Obviously, I hear your passion. I'm going to put this out there. Here's what you're saying, though. Think about, deconstruct what you're saying.
Okay.
You're saying that if Barack Obama just got out there right now and threw Dick Cheney or prosecuted Dick Cheney for the Iraq War, then the American public would have the confidence in his economic policies about why he needs additional why he needs additional authority for non-bank institutions to regulate non-banks in the way the FDIC is regulated so that we can get a handle on this economy so that all of us don't go down. I mean, that is what you're saying. You're making this very slippery connection between what I agree with you, Jeff. Listen, for one second. I agree with you that there is culpability that has not been brought to justice on in terms of the war in Iraq and whatnot. But I also, knowing as I understand and have seen this thing coming for a long time, realize that we have a bus headed toward us with this economic storm, and that if President Obama is going to get out there and throw people in jail because of the war in Iraq, you think that that's going to stop the bus from hitting you?
Nobody's talking about Guantanamo or any of that. Why pick Cheney? How about if went after Paulson? I don't know. Maybe looking at
what's the crime that Paulson did?
Are you kidding? Let's just look at what took place with Lehman Brothers alone. And it's not Lehman. It's Lehman Brothers. It is the fact that Hank Paulson had a running vengeance with Stoudt at Lehman Brothers. It's a documented currently as to the fact that he had a vengeance with this guy, a little competition going back and forth. Why would it be that was the only organization that was let to founder? Why is it that all of a sudden Goldman Sachs, the one nucleus of all of this, is all of a sudden having record profits and so on? So no, I'm not saying going after Cheney for those types of things.
Right, but now you're starting to, Jeff. You realize you can't just say crimes have been committed and then say that it's. I know I have a good fact that they hate each other.
Been committed because no one's looked into it.
Well,
I think you can't say nothing's happened. You can't say
no, I'm not. But we do have,
guys.
We do
Tucker
have
Carlson just
Jeff.
Exposed on your program, Nancy.
I agree.
No one questioned him on it.
I
that W is a liberal. It was the liberals who did all of this. George W. Bush is a liberal. Tucker Carlson just espoused that on your program, and he wasn't countered at all on that. I just don't understand how we are allowing these people just, right. I don't know if it's fear of a fight.
No, I found that interesting, Jeff. All right, now, come on. We're having a conversation
timing.
Here, right?
Timing.
Now, listen. So I think Congress should, in fact, be absolutely exerting their oversight authority in all of these matters to see if crimes were committed.
Right. Okay,
but
so
my bigger concern is, Jeff, just let me say something, okay? It is my show. The thing is, Jeff, what you got to do is that there was a lack of regulatory structure that made it even, it gave them the ability to do all this stuff. And that's what Obama is saying, that his major point in that speech, and he got the biggest applause today, was that we have to, as Krugman says, make banking boring again. We are going to have to re-regulate the whole situation so we never face this mess again.
Okay.
And what I fear what you might be doing, I'm not saying I don't agree with you that there were things happen. What you don't want to do is you don't want to muddle the environment such that you can't get done what you have to get done.
No, but what you need to do is get the attention of the entire population, and that includes these teabagging idiots that are out there. Where were all of these people when George Bush had a higher tax rate? Where were all of these people when $9.5 billion went missing in Iraq? Of their tax dollars. The facts are that these people are uneducated, and Fox is spending 2 hours a day minimum promoting something for the right wing. So I don't know why anybody would think Cheney's the only person that's committed any crimes here. Why would he be the person you would go after first? No, you do use timing. What is the pertinent subject matter of the issue right now? And that would be the financial issues. And if you look into the background of what Paulson has done, it's very easy to connect these dots. Extremely easy to connect these dots. And I keep hearing people say, being stupid isn't illegal. Are you kidding me? You mean to tell me tranches were just mistakes
hey,
that people made? Tranches were mistakes?
Hey, Jeff.
No one intended.
Jeff, you know what you need to do? You know what you need to do? Honestly, you need just a website. Get a blog. Just get a blog and a blog post. If you feel this passionately about organizing an effort to get Congress to have these hearings, I'm telling you what to do. I'm a radio host, Jeff.
Yeah.
I'm taking your call and letting you vent. But instead of just venting about it, get a blog, and I'm going to have you back on the show, Jeff. I'm saying I'm not dissing you. I'm saying do something about it, Jeff. Okay, now your next step is, if you feel strongly that they overstepped legal authority and it has to be then get the Jeff blog. I want you email me at nancy@nancyskinnerlive.com with your suggestions. We'll have people go to your blog, check out exactly what it is you're saying, that you allege the crimes that were committed or whatnot, or areas for possible investigation, and that's good. That's what this is about, democracy. But I just think my view is that you got a bus coming at you. You do. You really do have a bus coming at you. And if you're Obama, you have to make tons of choices quickly as an executive about the future. About the future. And that's where we are. And you got the teabaggers on your heels. These nonsense, yes, they're completely uneducated. It's ridiculous. But it is what it is. So what do you do about that? 1-888-64 Nancy. That's 646-2629. Wow! As Contessa Brewer of MSNBC was, wow! To James Boyce. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I am Nancy Skinner, 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 646-2629, the number to the program.
Thank you, Jeff, for calling in. I'm airing all views. I had Tucker Carlson on. Some people disagree with me. I'm always trying to take the calm adult approach here, except when I indulge in cheddar heading, because that's funny, too. But Jeff thinks we need to hold people accountable, and that's why, you know, President Obama today spent 45 minutes trying to explain what he's done already, the enormous steps that have been taken already to fix this mess, and what he's going to do, getting out in front of the teabaggers tomorrow, these national spontaneous protests about taxation and socialism and whatnot after this train wreck. And people are expressing their views on whether, you know, you get out in front of it, you do anything, it's good, it's bad, whatever. All right, so here's what I'm going to do, because I have my view, but I respect yours. I see on my screen that I said to John, I wondered if it was a typo. I have two Jacks in L.A. on the line, and they seem to be at opposite sides of this debate. So I thought it would be nifty if we brought our two Jacks from L.A. on the line with me, and we could talk amongst ourselves. So Jack number one, first of all, hello, Jack.
Hello, how are you doing, Nancy?
Very well, thank you. So I'm going to, if you will, do you agree to participate in a three-way discussion?
I'd love to.
Okay, great. So then the other Jack in Los Angeles. Hi, Jack. Hello. Jack 2.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, great. Okay, so first of all, Jack, you think I'm, Jack 1, you think I am being a tad bit too harsh in denigrating the teabaggers. Is that your point of view, and why don't you explain it?
Well, I don't think you're being harsh in denigrating the Newt Gingriches and the... you know, and the like, that are kind of co-opting what you, you know, refer to as this so-called patriot movement, which I see as the real people that are for peace and freedom in the country. And I think that the Gingriches have gotten out in front of them to stop what they're really doing, which is to try to get the Fed audited and to try to change the way that we do business as far as our foreign policy and our economic policy.
You think that this is a genuine movement, and that the Newt Gingriches of the world are trying to take advantage of it and harness
exactly.
it for their own gain?
Exactly. This thing comes out of the people who, like myself, I was a Bobby Kennedy person. The first person I voted for was McGovern. I've been a liberal almost all my life. And, you know, I don't know, liberal as far as just free thinking. But I think...
Well, that's what the word... All right. Anyways, go ahead. So you think... Continue, and then I'm going to let Jack 2 in here.
Okay. What I think is that where this movement started, this Tea Party and this freedom movement started, was with people that supported guys like Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul, who I think were the closest to what we needed. Even though, you know, I think this whole left-right thing is just good cop, bad cop. Because, probably the most left-wing member of Congress is supposedly Kucinich, and the most right-wing is Ron Paul. And yet both of them are the only ones that are for pulling our troops out of all these countries, stopping the empire, and taking care of business at home.
Okay, so Jack 2, do you think this is an authentic movement that's being hijacked by Newt Gingrich, or prefab protests to try and go after Obama for lack of anything better to do?
I think it's more prefab. I have no doubt that there is a percentage of people who it's a heartfelt deal for them. But when you look at the signs, voices, different things coming out of these meetings, it's basically an anti-Obama rally. And if the people truly understood American history, they would be able to put in perspective and understand that they're being used right now. The original Boston Tea Party was about letting businesses get over and not being treated fairly. As Tom Hartman put it, the Walmarts of the world, getting big breaks and putting the mom and pops out of business. That's what the Boston Tea Party was about. And to have corporate interests funding this and the super rich funding this, it's crazy. It should be a slap in the face to all of those real Americans out there, those who are real Americans.
Jack, he's got a point. If it were, you know...
I agree. I agree with him completely. But what I'm saying is, I think that Obama has been put in pretty much by the same group that got Bush in there. I think that the same power structure is in place. You know, I mean, when you take it from Paulson to Geithner...
And then before that, Larry Summers and the
yeah, but those are names. Those are names. When Obama comes out and regulates them, when he comes out and says, listen, I want to regulate non-bank institutions, in other words, insurance companies and whatnot, and what he said today was, this is never going to happen again. We are going to, you know what he was really saying? We are going to regulate the hell out of this industry so we don't have to clean up this mess again. And I don't think that's the same thing. That is not the same old power structure.
No, I think that Mr. Obama has some good ideas as far as regulating it. But my point is what should happen is this whole Federal Reserve thing should be taken apart.
Right.
Hold on,
Jack, I gotta let the other Jack have the last word here because we're out of time and I wasn't fair. Jack, too, go ahead.
I just think people need to really start thinking about our tax structure, and a lot of these people out there will consider themselves working class or middle class. And the working class and middle class that we think of America, that was built in the 40s, 50s, 60s under what they would say is oppressive taxation, 90 and 70-odd percent taxation. That's what built the country.
There you go.
It wasn't Reagan's 80, let's make Wall Street the
big deal. Right. I think he doth protest too much because they haven't done any of the tax rate stuff at all yet, the 1%. Thank you to my Jacks in L.A. for doing this engaging and vital debate with me. It will continue on The Nancy Skinner Show.
Now, you will recall that some argued this recovery plan is a case of irresponsible government spending, that it's somehow to blame for our long-term deficit projections, and that the federal government should be cutting instead of increasing spending right now. So I want to tackle this argument head on. To begin with, economists on both the left and the right agree that the last thing a government should do in the middle of a recession is to cut back on spending. You see, when this recession began, many families sat around the kitchen table and tried to figure out where they could cut back. So have many businesses. And this is a completely reasonable and understandable reaction. But if every family in America, if every business in America cuts back all at once, then no one is spending any money, which means there are no customers, which means there are more layoffs, which means that the economy gets even worse.
Which means we're in trouble for a long, long time. Which means we're so lucky we elected this guy President of the United States and that he has a smart group of people around him to figure out this mess that we got into. I should say that the last administration got us into, and now we're digging out of. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. What makes me Nancy Skinner? 1-888-646-2629. That's 1-888-64-Nancy. To put it another way, in other words, as George Bush used to say. All right. Not everybody is opposed to the president. Who is opposed to the president, I should say, is ready to pour into the streets with tea bags. Some people are, and some people are taking a more thoughtful approach to that. So joining me is we're gonna cover the gamut. We had Tucker Carlson on. We talked tea baggers. We have Ann Voice with me. Ann Voice, I'm sorry. She is the policy director for the New America Foundation, their fiscal policy program. And Ann, I'm happy to have you on to talk about the plan, the program, and your views on it. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Nancy. Happy to be here.
First of all, you know, the New America Foundation, I did the Wikipedia on it, and tell me a little bit about it, because it seems like you guys span the gamut of political views. I love Fareed Zakaria, so anyone who has him on, that's great. You have Republicans, Christine Todd Whitman, but you have on the right, too. You have the people, scholars from all parts of the spectrum. Why is that? I mean, tell me about your group first.
We try to take a bipartisan group of, or a human view, let's say, of all the challenges that we're facing today. And New America was founded not to be on the left, not to be on the right, but to provide a very human and sensible look at the issues that we're all facing today.
Okay, so how's that working out for you?
It's not easy, but it's good to do it that way. You know, we're trying to look, especially in the fiscal area, we're trying to look at what's good for America.
Okay, so I played for you, the reason I played that cut for you, Anne, is because I think I've read through your analysis and your concern about the fiscal, the deficits, really, that you are concerned about the spending burden that is, goes, is part and parcel with the bailout, with the package, with the recovery. You have to incur some deficit spending, and you guys have done an analysis on this. Did you hear the president's remarks, though, about that, that, you know, he addressed that concern directly? Did you hear his speech today?
Yeah, I did.
And what do you make of it? I mean, he said economists on the left and the right agree that the last thing you do is pull back spending when you're nosediving in a recession.
I think he's absolutely right. But the way that we look at it is that the deficit now is the good deficit, that you need to fill the hole caused by the weak economy and financial crisis. And you need to do it by taking a lot of policy steps that will stimulate spending, and that's what the president was talking about. But once the economy gets going, then you've got to take those deficits back, and that's when you get the bad deficit. So we see a good deficit now, bad deficit later, and you have to figure out how to get from one to the other. But I agree very much with what the president says about right now.
Well, so I guess I'm trying to get to your critique here, because he did say, you know, we've already begun steps going through line item on the budget, and we've identified $2 trillion, you say? $2 billion, and I don't even know what that number was. I have it somewhere. But he said, we've already done that, and we have to do more. He kept stressing, we have to do more in terms of that. But where is your critique? I mean, you got to spend now. The priorities that he's spending it on, the jobs, you know, there's an announcement about some work in Michigan. I'm in Michigan where we're really suffering. Energy, I mean, what is it that's not a good investment? The energy, smart grid, the healthcare investments that he made the point. We have to do this now. You don't wait on these types of investments in the future. If you have to spend it on something that makes sense, not on, you know, frivolous, I always say, you know, not on gummy bears. I mean, spend it on these things that have been neglected, these priorities, long-term priorities that have been neglected. So I don't understand where your disconnect is, Anne.
The disconnect is in about 3 or 4 years when the economy starts to pick up, and at the same time we're going to be having more and more baby boomers retire. And we can't afford all that at once, so we have to look where to cut back. But I'm in agreement with you about the priorities and what we should be doing now and how we have a lot of investment that we need to make up for. So I think that that what's being done now is good, but I think in about 3 or 4 years we have to have a big national conversation about how to get our spending more in line with what we can afford.
So based on what are you, are there certain numbers? Do you see a tipping point as a percent of debt, as a percent of GDP, based on what? You know, what is scaring you? I know that I'm a finance major, deficit hawk, went to U of M. I don't like deficits. I didn't like when they ran them up over the last 8 years, frankly, in good times when we should have been making these investments. But now we're in a deflationary, producer prices fell. I don't know if you saw that report.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
So that's why the market tanked today. Our retail sales were down. They had just started to come out of the tank. They go down. But the real thing that scared the bejesus out of all of the investors was producer prices fell. And what have I been saying? For how long? Deflation is the worst monster you can fight in economic battles. And I've been saying this is what has been on the horizon because of these big macro issues for a long time. So here we are. We're fighting the monster, the big bad monster of all economic monsters. You got to throw everything at it. And so I don't understand, you know, essentially there's nothing, you're not saying do anything different until we get through the crisis and then pull back.
Right. And I think they're doing the right things right now. We might, you know, a lot of people in Washington are talking behind the scenes about do we need even more stimulus, but they're waiting to see the stimulus that was passed a couple months ago work through the economy. So people very much have their pulse, people from the left, people from the right, on what's happening with the economy. Will we need to do more? Is this enough? But if you look at the administration's longer-run projections starting in about 2012, when the economy probably will be doing, we hope, pretty well, the deficit-to-GDP ratio is far too high. We can't afford it. It's going to hurt the future generation if we don't do something about it sooner rather than later. And that's where our problem is. It's with not the good deficit now, but the bad deficit in about 5 years.
But the good goes with the bad. You save yourself. If you're drowning, you get out. You know, you save yourself first. You're going to be wet for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's the way it goes, and then you deal with it. You take one step at a time. Now, listen, Ann, I know you also have you published some viewpoints about the automakers in Detroit. And since I'm in Detroit, you don't feel like that this is a prudent investment to help the automakers get through this.
I think we've had no choice. I don't think it is anyone's preferred first best solution, but I think there's just no choice given the automakers, the suppliers, the employment questions, the deflation issue. I think there's just been no choice. The question moving ahead is, how do we get out of it? And you all are grappling with that more than anyone else.
Oh, yeah. Trust me, and have been for some time, personally, on lots of levels as well. But so you think that this is an appropriate role for government to help restructure the auto industry so that they will be competitive in the future? And if we need to have a Band-Aid in the interim while the credit crunch is upon us, then so be it?
It's not something that people who work on the issues like we do normally would say, but these are extraordinary times. That being said, our view is that you have to make the market involved as much as possible, and this is the challenge with what's being done now with the automakers, of having the government step in, provide resources, provide some transition, and perhaps work in a public-private partnership for the future, but getting the balance right between that public-private partnership. That's the tough one.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's been done in other countries, though. For a long time, the reason Prius was subsidized by Japan, all the technology, Germany's done the same. They've had these public-private partnerships that have gotten them out, you know, with advanced technologies and giving their industries competitive advantages that, you know, we here have eschewed totally. You can't do that in some way. So I think the balance right now, yeah, maybe this is having an auto task force in town is a little extreme, but I think that's just we're in ER. We are in ER. That as soon as the patient is back in the room, I don't think the government wants to be running the auto industry.
No.
But
no,
they had no choice but to rescue the patient, a patient to which, you know, the vitality of the whole hospital, the whole economy is important, you know, the greater good kind of thing.
If the auto industry can rally around the future, the energy questions, the battery question, given the talented labor force, given the talented workforce, given the talented executives, then I think that there will be a brighter future for Detroit and Flint.
Well, there will be. That is exactly where we're heading, Ann. So it doesn't sound like you and I are all that off course in our beliefs and views and coming at this, how we're coming at this whole crisis. So I appreciate you sharing your time with us. Ann Voris is the policy director at the New America Foundation. Thanks, Ann.
Quite welcome.
Okay. You know, I thought she was on the other side of the issues given some of their focus on this. But, you know, see what you can learn? Sometimes you just by talking, we're closer than we think, perhaps from what she wrote. And they have scholars all across the spectrum, so I thought that was pretty interesting. 1-888-646-2629. That's 1-888-64-NANCY. More on this, because I want to hone in on one cut of the president today that I found interesting, something new, something very new. He's addressing another argument out there that we've been known to talk about here on the Nancy Skinner Show. So we'll have it up next. that. He's so, always so interesting to see a major speech like this. And then the reaction. I love the reaction part of it, too, because I ingest it. And then I like to see how everyone else ingests it. So we have a little bit of that coming up now. On the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY. New York Times has a piece out on their website right now saying that the White House had previewed this speech today that the president gave, an address to Georgetown University, as a major speech on the economy. But Mr. Obama did not break new ground. They said he did not. He did, however, use the occasion to reaffirm his determination to do something about the rising cost of health care and later to shore up Social Security. The president seemed to guard against being tagged as liberal. For instance, he defended the administration decision not to take over failing banks. Government should practice the same principle as doctors, first do no harm, and at another point invoked religious imagery. Let's break that down about doing nothing new in this speech, because I heard something new. He addressed all his critics. He addressed those people who said that the stimulus was just too much spending, that everybody agrees you can't do that. He addressed those critics who are just taking to the street, believing that why shouldn't the bailouts go to just people on the streets, like average people, instead of through the banks, and why that's important, that the banks have to be fixed. And then he touched on an area that we've talked about quite a bit here.
Now, on the other hand, there have been some who don't dispute that we need to shore up the banking system, but they suggest that we've been too timid in how we go about it. This is essentially the nationalization argument that some of you may have heard. And the argument says that the federal government should have already preemptively stepped in and taken over major financial institutions the way that the FDIC currently intervenes in smaller banks. And that our failure, my administration's failure to do so, is yet another example of Washington coddling Wall Street. Why aren't you tougher on the banks? So let me be clear. The reason we have not taken this step has nothing to do with any ideological or political judgment we've made about government involvement in banks. It's certainly not because of any concern we have for the management and shareholders whose actions helped to cause this mess. Rather, it's because we believe that preemptive government takeovers are likely to end up costing taxpayers even more in the end, and because it's more likely to undermine than create confidence. Governments should practice the same principle as doctors. First, do no harm.
What do you think of that? 1-888-64-NANCY, number to the program. Essentially, the first time I've heard the president himself really address this point directly, head on, which is, okay, if we're going to give the boats, let me try and do it in Nancy-ese, Nancy-lese. If we're going to give the banks a boatload of money, then, you know, my premise has been, we better figure out which ones are insolvent and which are illiquid and cut our losses. He essentially came back and said today, the reason we don't do that is because we think that that'll end up costing more for us to do it. That's one reason he gave. And the second one was, it could undermine the confidence in the markets and end up causing some downward rally, is what he's really saying. So I'm on the other side, I'm going to tell you a little bit about, assess both of those, because I'm hearing them. I'm hearing those arguments. I'm a thoughtful person, and we're going to see what you think about it. 1-888-646-2629. That's 1-888-64-NANCY. I'd love to see what Paul Krugman's going to make of this. You know he's going to be all over it, because that was the Krugman thing. So more to come on the other side. Goldman Sachs, too. They're going to give their money back. We'll have fun with that, too, on the Nancy Skinner Show.
I can call you Betty. Betty, when you call me, you can call me out. A man walks down the street and says, why am I short of attention? Got a short little span of attention, and all my nights are so long. Where's my wife and family?
All right, let's reset this because I want to make sure we get this right. The Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY. If you're just tuning in, I'm still talking about President Obama's big speech today on the economy, on the eve of the night that rocked the world. the teabaggers taken to the streets. Okay, besides that sideshow, freak sideshow in my view. President Obama did say something new today, despite what the New York Times said. He addressed for the first time a criticism kind of across the spectrum, including the argument for nationalization of the banks. So just, it's worth taking another listen.
Now, on the other hand, there have been some who don't dispute that we need to shore up the banking system, but they suggest that we've been too timid in how we go about it. This is essentially the nationalization argument that some of you may have heard. And the argument says that the federal government should have already preemptively stepped in and taken over major financial institutions, the way that the FDIC currently intervenes in smaller banks. And that our failure, my administration's failure to do so, is yet another example of Washington coddling Wall Street. Why aren't you tougher on the banks? So let me be clear. The reason we have not taken this step has nothing to do with any ideological or political judgment we've made about government involvement in banks. It's certainly not because of any concern we have for the management and shareholders whose actions helped to cause this mess. Rather, it's because we believe that preemptive government takeovers are likely to end up costing taxpayers even more in the end, and because it's more likely to undermine than create confidence. Governments should practice the same principle as doctors. First, do no harm.
Okay, there you have it. President Obama saying, addressing the argument for nationalization of the banks, something I'd been out on for a long time saying it needed to happen because I follow Nouriel Roubini, who's just talked about the, you know, what we don't know is whether they're just sort of insolvent because of the crisis, or they are illiquid because of the crisis, or completely insolvent. And what the president said that was new to my ears today was, one, he talked about, well, it could cost us more, and two, could it cause a crisis of confidence if you take over the banks? And I'm going to just point out a couple of things through history in my reading of this, because I had to sit back and go, now that's interesting and that's new information I'm taking in. Going back, we had here's what's different about now in the Depression. Certainly there was a crisis of confidence back during the Depression and very similar elements. Here's what's different. It wasn't as bad. Now it's not as bad as it was back then. They were already at a tipping point of confidence, such to the extent that the bankers themselves were hungry for nationalization. That's how bad it was. You had Walter Lippmann and all these big thinkers at the time out there. I guess he'd be the Paul Krugman of the day, I guess, Walter Lippmann. There's so many analogies, if you could rewrite this, calling for FDR to have almost, what'd they say, dictatorial powers, Lippmann at one point called for. And they were like, whoa, rein him in on that, okay? We don't want that. Eleanor Roosevelt's like, we don't even want, that's not what we want. We're trying to solve a problem. You're not being helpful. But here's what was unprecedented. What we don't have now is that they had support across the political spectrum. That this is on the eve of the closing of the banks, where FDR closed them down for like a week or something, and they had an orderly reopening. People were so hungry for this to happen when he was elected that there was a spirit of corporatism. They wrote a letter of all these different people, these groups, I'll tell you, a letter of support for the President of the United States. And on March 6th of 1933, and it was addressed to a conference of governors that was to meet at the White House. And let's see, other signers on this letter included Rear Admiral Richard Byrd, Newton Baker, go on and on and on. Essentially, Chamber of Commerce, and the Federation of Labor, American Farm Bureau. That you had bankers, even they talk about the tenor of bankers back then, that at this point, some bankers were so totally drained of confidence in themselves and their colleagues, so demoralized by felt popular hostility to them. Well, that's going on. If not also by private feelings of guilt, private convictions of social justice, that they saw no way to avoid a socialization of the banking system. that is a pooling of existing bank assets into a single central national bank having myriad local branches, the whole to be government-owned, government-operated. And this willingness to nationalize was far stronger throughout the banking community in general than it was among the big bankers called to Washington, as the latter well knew. The great majority of the nation's banks were insolvent. And one thing our capitalists are always willing to socialize is a loss, as Kenneth Burke remarked, a commentator at the time. So here's what's different. They'd gotten to the point already where these banks were closing and bad, and people just, some smart professors said, you know what, if we do close the banks down, instead of it being this huge crisis of confidence, it could be a relief because people could feel like there's a bottom. And FDR had to make a tough choice there back then. And he chose to, he knew that something had to be done. And he chose to do the National Bank holiday as soon as he attained power at midnight under the Trading with the Enemy Act. They closed the banks at a national bank holiday for a week, and then he called an emergency session of Congress to legitimize what he had done and to authorize a slow reopening of the banks so that people felt like, okay, we're going to take a deep breath, we're going to figure out who's who, get our bearings straight, close these banks. And you know what happened? Pretty much these professors were right, and FDR was right, that people found creative ways to use the currency without banks being opened. There was some hardship, and they had to adjust for that in areas like Michigan, of course, which I found to be funny in this book that said Michigan was the hardest hit back then. I mean, this story, you could rewrite this story with today's characters. It's so bizarre. But they eventually slowly did over, started within a week and then slowly went through and reorganized those banks and reopened those banks. And there was not a major run that people use. And there is local script being invented and used in communities. I saw that the front article on USA Today. Where was it? Detroit. Printing their own script currency, if you will. It's already going on. So I think the crisis of confidence is there. The difference is you don't have the unity of national purpose that apparently they had back then. So the question I am, as I'm mulling over his statements and hearing this, because he's got smarter people working, he's got a whole administration, I'm just me, okay, is are we at, we're not at that tipping point that we need to just dive in because we don't have that unity of purpose, that we haven't suffered quite enough that we have to go in and seize those banks, that in fact could cause, do you think nationalizing banks could cause the crisis deficit or would resolve it? That's essentially where the jury is out in my book. Would nationalizing the banks deepen it, the crisis confidence, or would it relieve people to know that, okay, finally, you know, these banks, we don't know what's going on, and I'm going to talk a little bit just here in the end about Goldman Sachs. This is such a different situation from back then. You have Goldman Sachs now, who, remember, they reorganized themselves as a bank holding company when this whole crisis started so as to enable themselves to get those TARP funds. And so, because they weren't, they were an investment bank, and they turned themselves into a bank so that they could get a boatload of money. Now they, after having been a counterparty to AIG and gotten their bailout, and after a change in accounting rules, I know I'm speaking gibberish now, mark to marketing, which allowed them to revalue their assets, they were able to report a profit. So now they wrote it out, this bank, okay, because we've got these changes, we're going to give you the money back. All right? So we're going to have a $10 billion offering to be able to say we're going to pay the government back our share, $10 billion worth of funds. Everyone says, great, short term, right? But essentially what that does is we got ours, we got our counterpayments, we came out, you changed the rule, we're going to give the money back so that we're going to look better and than the banks that aren't as solvent, that aren't as good yet, because they're still struggling, those banks are going to look worse by comparison. Do you get what I'm saying? So they have to get approval from the Treasury to be able to even give that money back. And I will tell you that that's going to be the next argument politically, that, wait a minute, now the government is saying to the banks, don't give the money back? And it's going to be easier to make that commentary out there and incite the teabaggers, they don't even want the money back. Then it is a thoughtful analysis of why that might be, because you took the money when you needed it. In fact, you turned yourself into a different type of entity just so you could get it. And they changed the way your books are accounting. And now you want to be the first ones to say, look at us, we're great, right? And then everyone else goes down. So that's not so good for the smaller banks that aren't quite there yet. Meanwhile, the president is saying, hey, if we do nationalize the banks, we could cause a crisis of confidence. Well, you know what? He's a pretty smart guy. He and I don't have many areas where we depart. It's a thoughtful comment, and I'm thinking about it. My question is, would be, if I were White House press corps, is if we don't do it, do we just keep muddling along till we get to that tipping point? Or do you go in and take care of it now and then have that relief of, okay, it's done. We know who's insolvent. We know who's illiquid. They're not lying to us. They're not playing games. They're not Goldman Sachsing each other to see who's on top, who's on bottom. Do you know what I'm saying? Do you understand what I'm saying? Please, someone tell me that you get this, because it's really heavy stuff, but you're going to need to know it because it's the next battle on the horizon. 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 1-888-646-2629. I did not write Schoolhouse Rock, or If I Was a Bill, or whatever it's called, but I do know a little bit about banking and crisis of confidence in the Depression. So thoughts on that. We're not there quite yet. I want to hear Nuriel Rubini says. By the way, his people are going to get him on the show, so we'll look forward to that. That's way more exciting than Tucker Carlson. I'll let you know well in advance of Nuriel Rubini on The Nancy Skinner Show. Of the universe have plan B. Give the money back. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-888-64-NANCY. That's 646-2629, the number to the program. So, you know, I was just going wandering through President Obama's speech about nationalization and wandering through the history books of what FDR did at that moment when the banks were kind of in the same thing, insolvent, illiquid. We didn't know. There were bad banks, bad assets, same kind of thing, different factors contributing. And now add to the mix, our bankers aren't quite as humble yet as they were back then at that point, at the breaking point. Goldman Sachs is saying, you know what? We don't want your money. We don't want the money that came, you know, too much thing, too many restrictions on my bonuses, so we're going to give it back. Well, they were counterparties. That's how they got money from AIG. They got TARP funds. So when they give it back, everyone says, well, that sounds like a good thing. Give it back. But if you do it quick, it's for their own. It is one. The guys who are doing this is the top management, and they don't want their bonuses somehow to be touched. And two, when they do it, what that does is the reason there was the blanket TARP is that so people wouldn't say, well, okay, so Goldman Sachs is good, and this bank that didn't immediately give it back the next day is bad. It's another kind of run. Do you understand that? That's what it is. It's a different kind of run, and that is the more thoughtful consideration than just getting out into the street with a bunch of teabaggers protesting something that hasn't even happened. 1-888-64-NANCY, my dilemma as such. Out to Los Angeles again with Carol. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Nancy.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me on the show. I just want to let you know you're so right about all that. I mean, we need to look at history. We need to look at FDR and see what happened, you know, back in the 30s.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it certainly is. If I had the spare time, I would do this is a screenplay, definitely, because the actors, and if you read this book and what's happening now, there are so many parallels, except for one big one, Carol, and I will give this to the president. The big one that is not in place is there wasn't the kind of unity of of opinion and cooperation, and we got to do something. Now we're all grabbing each other's neck, you know.
Right.
It's like when someone's drowning, the person who's trying to save them, they have to protect themselves and stay alive because that other person will take them down. That's one of the first lessons in when you're in rescue class or something. That's kind of where we are. Do you get that?
They could do this as like a split screen movie, you know.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
FDR on one side and Obama on the other side, and do the parallels.
Yeah, with the different characters and
right.
The same crisis, and it really is it's very instrumental. So, well, thanks, Carol. I appreciate you calling in. Appreciate that. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. What I'm saying to you is, one. I'm glad I'm not the President of the United States. These are tough decisions. He's really, really tough. And I do want to see now what Paul Krugman and Nouriel Roubini's response will be to the President's statement that, in fact, that by nationalizing the banks, you could cause the crisis in confidence that you are seeking to restore. You get that? I mean, it's the first time, really, that argument had been made to me, and I understand that. And, like I said, with this situation with Goldman Sachs, you know, when you start the life-saving example, when one bank tries to save itself by giving the money back, essentially, too prematurely, he could be submersing the other banks, tagging them, labeling them by Goldman's actions as, we're the good bank, you're a bad bank, and you could start a different kind of run. That is the very, very tough issue that we're trying to grapple with. Devon is in Astoria, Oregon. Oh, yay, Astoria. Hi, Devon.
It's Devin, but close enough.
Hi, Devin. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I get it a lot. I'm sorry if I'm a little nervous the first time I've called you.
No, just me.
Well, you know, it's a national audience. So.
Yeah, that's okay. We like Oregon.
I'm calling in regards to a couple of reports I heard about these tea parties that are coming about. And they're actually, I heard about the Homeland Security putting out a document to all of the police agencies to be on guard for a rise in violent attacks by conservative extremists. I don't have a problem with conservatives. I debate frequently with conservatives, different beliefs, different values, and that's how you come about a viable solution. But an extremist is an extremist. And
mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you had heard anything about this.
Yeah, I did. I saw a report. Huffington Post has a report right now saying that they're worried about sort of backlash, right-wing extremism being vented in this. That's the whole thing, is that when you give people, that's what scares me about a venue like this, protests, you give people that sort of environment, they can cause news, cause trouble, create a situation. Glenn Beck is doing a lot of this. I mean, you had some shootings in Philadelphia against a police guy who said, police officers, three were killed tragically, citing Obama's crackdown on guns, which,
well,
you know,
and that they're just trying, they're just building to the case against it, and it just kills me. You know, and I'm an Iraq veteran, and I know how quickly a mob mentality can take over overrun the streets.
Well, yeah, you are correct. That concerns me a lot. It does. I don't like to feed into it, Devin, so that's why I don't talk about that stuff too much. I've had people say, you know, why don't you? It's a legitimate issue, because I believe you can feed stuff and you can further it, and I try to go the other direction. But you're raising a good point. And tomorrow we'll be talking about it, that's for sure. Teabag day, tax day. It's just tax day, okay? I like the cheeseheading thing better myself, personally. But we'll grapple with the real big issues, and we'll talk about it all tomorrow on the Nancy Skinner Show.